Well, howdy y'all. Welcome to episode number 60 of Once Upon a Time in Texas. I am your host, Michael Mitchell. So I don't have a lot of random stuff to report, but I will tell a story on my grandmother that my mother relayed to me. Grandma found this little box-shaped thing in the pocket of her jacket. And she sends a picture and a message to my mother and says, "What is this? Is somebody tracking me?" Because it had a number, a digital number on the front. And it was just this little tiny box. Well, Mom looked at the picture and thought, "Gosh sakes, what is that?" And then zoomed in a little further and it had a little, not advertisement, but a little sign on it that said, "Waffle Champion." Mom looks it up and it's a restaurant not far from where they live in a retirement community. And Mom calls her back and says, "Hey, when did you eat at Waffle Champion?" My grandmother responded, "Well, we ate there yesterday. How did you know about that?" It turns out it's one of those buzzers, you know, when you go to a restaurant and, you know, normally they use it for seating. But in this case, you go up and order and then they give you this little thing and it buzzes whenever your food's ready. Apparently, Grandma didn't understand that, stuck it in her pocket and sat down and waited for a little bit and then decided, well, how the heck do they know where we are? When our food's done. And so she went up and she asked the guy that was making lunch or, you know, whatever, breakfast, I guess. And the guy said, "Did they not give you a little box?" And my grandmother said, "Well, no." And he said, "Don't worry about it. I'll just bring your food out." So apparently it never buzzed in her pocket or whatever. And she took it home and thought someone was tracking her. So anyway, That's my grandmother. Love her so much, man. It just cracks me up. And my mother said, "You know, I've told a couple of people this story, and I'm worried they're going to think that she has dementia, but she's always been this way." And it's true. I have several stories of my grandmother and some of the goofy things that she's done. But a wonderful lady nonetheless, was a kindergarten teacher forever, and pretty much deserves sainthood in my book for that. So that's just random stuff from my life that came up that kind of tickled my fancy. And it has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm doing my podcast on this week. So many states have ghost towns. And they usually happen for, you know, one reason or another. A lot has to do with whatever the local economy depends on, going away. Sometimes, though, it has to do with the weather, you know, in the area. Or maybe a new railroad or highway that's going through another town or bypassing this town altogether. But whatever the case may be, here are a few famous ones for Texas. And I guess I will say, Grandma gave me a book called Ghost Towns of Oklahoma, and I think that really piqued my interest in ghost towns and basically why some places were the way they were. So thank you, Grandma. There's the loop in with Grandma. Didn't think about it till just now. So before we take a look at these few famous ghost towns, I'd like to thank our sponsor, which is me and Victory Home Loans. I know there's tons of people out there moving, even with things the way they are. And if you know any of them, send them my way. It's themichaelmitchell.com, themichaelmitchell.com. Why not work with someone who's at least a little entertaining and works hard to make the whole process faster, cheaper, and easier? Someone like me. And I do want to give a shout out real quick to Michael Battalino in our Rotary Club. He came in yesterday to the club and he leaned over and looked at me and he said, "You know, and if you know someone moving to or in Texas or Oklahoma, go to the Michael Mitchell." And I smiled and I said, "Well, I'm making a difference at least to one person. So, Michael, when you hear this, you're probably lifting weights. So, keep it up, buddy. Look forward to sitting down and chatting with you again pretty soon. So, where did this week's idea come from? Well, someone the other day mentioned something about Spanish Fork, Texas, which is just east of where I live, I don't know, 45 miles or so. It's near Nocona, way up right on the Red River. And they said, I wonder how long the Spanish were there. And I was like, you know what? Funny story. It was never a Spanish colony at all. And so that kind of got me thinking about some ghost towns. And although there are officially like 511 ghost towns in Texas, here are 10 that I found kind of interesting. And I'm going to give you a little history on each one. This may be a little longer podcast, but I'll do what I can. So Spanish Fork was once called Indian town, and was fortified in the 18th century. I believe it was fortified by the Toyabaya Indians and the French. But later, Anglo immigrants who discovered Spanish artifacts in the ruins of a fort nearby gave the settlement the incorrect name of Spanish Fork. So according to Spanish records, the Toyabayas built two permanent settlements nearby on either side of the Red River between 1750 and 1757. According to legend, Colonel Diego Ortiz Perea oversaw a campaign of revenge against the Toyabaya and Comanche Indians in 1759 after they had looted the Presidio San Luis de las Amarillas. The Toyabayan town was guarded by some 6,000 Indians who were flying a French flag and was fortified with entrenchments, wooden stockades, and a moat when several hundred Spanish soldiers arrived. 4 hours of fighting ended with the Spanish retreating. They even abandoned their two cannons and baggage train. The Spanish had established peace with the Indians by 1771, but continuing theft, particularly of horses, prompted Lieutenant Governor of the Natchitoches province, which I think is where the name Nacogdoches come from. He comes up and visits in 1778. He convinces the Toyabayas to hand over the two cannons and gave the area the name San Teodoro. Smallpox epidemics that started in 1778 and American expansion following the Louisiana Purchase in 1803 really just kind of decimated the Toyabaya's population. And their abandoned fortification in San Teodoro around 1841 and allowed it to deteriorate after that. The Toyabayas had long since left, so any early white settler who visited the ruins in 1859 didn't know anything about their past and imagined that it was a former Spanish fort, hence the name. Near the site of San Teodoro, a town by the name of Burlington had grown by the 1870s. And for cattle drivers traveling towards the Chisholm Trail, it functioned as a watering spot. The community there expanded and the locals petitioned for a post office in 1876. However, according to postal officials, their application was denied because another post office with the same name already existed. So the incorrect name of Spanish Fort was proposed by two local men in honor of the surrounding ruins, which were obviously Spanish. After the new name was approved, the post office in Spanish Fort was established in 1877. It had a whole bunch of development, but one of the most interesting things, there was a number of saloons, the most well-known of which was J.W. Schrock's Cowboy Saloon, where cattlemen gathered to partake in drink and tell tales. But a guy named Herman Joseph Justin started a boot business that eventually developed into Justin Industries in the town plaza, which is now known as Justin Boot Company. And to have their personalized boots completed in time for them to pick up on their trip south again from their cattle drive. So Justin took orders from the drivers heading north. So Spanish Fork gets a reputation of being a nasty little town. Later, Justin's wife claimed that during the height of the cattle industry, there had been over 40 killings. In fact, on one Christmas morning, three men had been murdered before breakfast. Lots of outlaws hiding out in the Indian Territory would travel across the Red River to Spanish Fork to get supplies. Of course, they would always stir up stuff. So eventually, the cattle path shifted further west. The Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railway omitted the town, and pretty much Spanish Fork kind of fell into disrepair. Justin Boots relocated the business to the nearby town of Nocona in the late 1880s. And I believe they're officially based out of Justin, Texas now. And then their population just kind of dwindles and there's just not a whole lot else going on out there. So, however, last time I was out that way a few years ago, the school was still there and there was a nice couple that was converting it into a home. So I thought that was kind of cool. So Catarina, Texas is next. Catarina is on Highway 83, 10 miles southeast of Asherton in southern Dimmitt County, which is kind of east-southeast of Del Rio. The name has been associated with the area since at least 1778. Legend holds that it is the name of a Mexican woman killed by Indians on or near the site. The town was established after Asher Richardson, a rancher, decided to build a railway link from Artesia Wells to his planned town of Asherton. In return for an easement through the nearby Taft Catarina Ranch, Richardson agreed to allow the ranch to establish a railroad depot with cattle shipping pens on his railroad. By 1910, when the Asherton and Gulf Railway began operations, the cattle pens had become the nucleus of a small community built by Joseph Green, the manager of the ranch. Green moved the ranch headquarters to the depot and added a bunkhouse, a commissary, a hotel, a post office, and a small schoolhouse. By 1915, the little town had 25 residents and had become famous in the area for the Taft House, an expensive mansion that Charles Taft, the owner of the ranch, supposedly built with oversized bathtubs to accommodate his brother, President William Howard Taft, which we know as the chunkiest president we've ever had. So that's funny, the oversized bathtubs. That's why it's in here. Catarina Farms, a development project, built roads, sidewalks, and waterworks, and an impressive new hotel, and installed electric power and a telephone exchange. Agent Charles Ladd imported entire orchards of fruit-laden citrus trees to impress prospective investors with the area's agricultural possibilities. By 1929, Catarina had between 1,000 and 2,500 residents, a bank, two grocery stores, a lumber company, and a bakery. Short supplies of water, marketing problems, and the Great Depression really hurt the town. By 1931, the population had dropped to 592, with many of its businesses forced to close. In 1943, Catarina had 403 residents and seven businesses. 56 had 380 and three businesses. By 1969, some of the town's most picturesque old buildings had been abandoned, and the population was down to 160. In 1990, the population was 45, but in 2000, it had grown to 135. So, Catarina, Texas. I added it in because of the oversized bathtub to accommodate his brother, the president, William Howard Taft. I still love that. Barstow. Barstow was organized in 1892 by George E. Barstow, who was one of the world's leading experts on irrigation. Could you imagine that? 1892 being the world's leading expert in irrigation. The same year, Barstow was elected first Ward County seat. A courthouse was built the following year, and by 1900, the city's population was over 1,000. Due to the recruiting efforts of Mr. Barstow, irrigation was successful enough that in the 1904 World's Fair, Barstow managed to win a silver medal for its grapes, which I thought was interesting. That same year, fruit and vegetable farming was hit hard when the Pecos River Dam broke. After that, droughts followed, and by 1918, farming was impossible. The population in 1930 was less than 468, and then it continued to dwindle on from there. So Barstow, Texas, way out in West Texas. Check it out sometime. Glen Rio. If anybody knows anything about Route 66, you know about Glen Rio. Glen Rio was originally the town of Rock Island. It's an unincorporated community in both Deaf Smith County, Texas, and Quay County, New Mexico. Located on the former U.S. Route 66, or Route 66, it sits literally on the Texas-New Mexico state line. And it was founded in 1903 as a railroad siding on the Rock Island Railroad. Its name is derived from Scottish glen, so Scots, you know, meaning a glen or kind of a meadow, and the Spanish word for rio. So it literally means Glen River. Originally a railroad town, the village was renamed from Rock Island to Glen Rio by the Rock Island and Pacific Railroad in 1908 and began receiving motorists on the dusty Ozark Trail in 1917. Its original structures were adobe buildings, and the circa 1910 Angel House was on the New Mexico side. The Ozark Trail was formed into U.S. Route 66 on November 11, 1926. By the 1930s, Route 66 was paved. Two-lane roads served locally by several filling stations, a restaurant, and a motel. It was widened in the 50s. A Texaco station and a diner were constructed in the Texas side using the Art Deco modern architectural style. So here's where it gets interesting. The location of Glen Rio on Texas and New Mexico border led to some interesting business practices. Now, I just love this. This crap cracks me up. At one point, all fuel was dispensed on the Texas side due to New Mexico's higher gasoline taxes. The 1930 State Line Bar and Motel were built in New Mexico because Deaf Smith County, Texas was dry. So you could actually stay in the hotel and the bar and drink. And then you could take a short stroll and be back in Texas. The railroad station was actually in Texas. The local post office was built around 1935 and was in New Mexico. They also built a water tank and a windmill in New Mexico in 1945. The Joseph Brownlee House, constructed in Amarillo in 1930, was moved to Glen Rio in 1950. Glen Rio was the site of the first motel in Texas / last motel in Texas, which they also ran the State Line Cafe, a gas station, and then later they changed it to the Texas Longhorn Motel, but was closed in 1976. Other businesses straddled the state line for many years until I-40 bypassed the community in September of 1973. So, went into decline really in 1975. 73-75 when it bypassed the town. For years, there was a simmering dispute over which state the east part of Glen Rio was lawfully part of. The straight north-south border between New Mexico and Texas was originally defined as the 103rd meridian, but the 1859 survey that was supposed to mark the boundary mistakenly set the border between 2.29 and 3.77 miles too far west, making the current lines of Texline, Farwell, Bledsoe, Bronco, and the eastern part of Glen Rio appear to be in Texas. So apparently there was a little bit of a whizzing contest for years, and it's a disputed strip hundreds of miles long because they did not survey it right. That's why surveying is important. And there was a bill passed in the New Mexico Senate to fund and file a lawsuit in the U.S. Supreme Court to recover that strip from Texas, but the bill did not become law. And today, land in this little strip is included in Texas land surveys, and the land and towns, especially the east part of Glen Rio, for all purposes are taxed and governed by the state of Texas. Happens a lot. Winkleman, Texas. This one is an interesting one. And here's why. You'll hear in just a second. In 1983, a guy named Ray Winkleman, a Brenham developer, a Brenham, Texas developer and antiques dealer, had the idea to bring more people to the area. So he purchased a 5-acre lot outside of the city of Brenham and started buying historical buildings. And he eventually managed to own about 150 structures. His goal was to create a town made up of restored historic buildings and make it a tourist destination. He moved his collection of 19 restored buildings to the site, including schoolhouses, plantation houses, a saloon, and a general store. There were even a few homes, and at one time had 93 full-time employees. The Texas State Historical Association says Winkleman lost the property to the Washington County State Bank in 1986. The town was auctioned off in 1989, going through several more changes of ownership. By 1994, the historic structures were not in use and falling down due to lack of maintenance, which is really sad. So as a result, Winkleman, Texas became a ghost town without it ever being an actual town in the first place. And that's why it's on the list. Number 6, Indianola. This is a ghost town located on the Matagorda Bay in Calhoun County, Texas. It was once the county seat of Calhoun County and is part of the Victoria, Texas Metropolitan Statistical Area. In 1875, the city had a population of 5,000 people, but September 15th of 1875, a powerful hurricane hit, killed between 150 and 300 people, and almost entirely destroyed the town. They rallied together, rebuilt the town, only to get wiped out again August 19th, 1886, by another intense hurricane, and then to add insult to injury, a fire consumed pretty much what was left. So, what is interesting about Indianola? Well, it was actually a German point of entry. So, a guy from Germany named Prince Karl of Solms-Braunfels, representing the Adelsverein, I'm probably saying that wrong. If you're German, I'm sorry. He selected Indian Point, which was the name of the town originally, in December 1844 as the port of entry for the Verein colonist from Germany. Prince Solms renamed the port Karlshafen in honor of himself, of course. Count Karl of Castell and Count Victor August of Leiningen-Westerberg, whom Solms claimed to have been christened, Karl Prince Solms, decided it was inadequate for accommodations as a port of entry, as well as a very isolated route to New Braunfels. And part of this, it was a little inadequate, but then they decided, you know what? It's hard to reach, and it's very isolated, and we want to keep the Germans that are going over there from interacting with any Americans. So in February 1845, Henry Francis Fisher conspired with Dr. F. Schubert to coerce incoming immigrants to sign legal documents disassociating themselves from the Verein and joining Schubert's colony in Milam County. So in May 1846, John O. Musbach received a letter from Count Castell informing him 4,304 colonists were on their way to Texas. With no funds and no new settlements, the mass of immigrants were stalled at Karlshafen, Indian Point. So Musebach's request to the Verein for more money and his warnings at pending bankruptcy for the Verein brought no results. As a last resort, Musenbach instructed D.H. Kleiner to publish the plight in the German news media. Embarrassed by the publicity, the Varian established an inadequate $60,000 letter of credit. Musenbach had arranged with the Tory brothers for transporting these immigrants inland, but the United States hired the Tory brothers for use in the Mexican-American War, so hired them away. So then these Germans are still trying to get to the towns of New Braunfels and Fredericksburg, and an epidemic of spinal meningitis breaks out and spread throughout these immigrants, who ended up moving to New Braunfels and Fredericksburg and apparently passed along these spinal meningitis. So where did Indianola start? Well, a guy named Samuel Addington White and William Cook founded it in August of 1846. The settlement developed along a corridor of beachfront for about 23 blocks. And in 1849, it changed its name from Indian Point to Indianola. And in 1852, Calhoun County selected Indianola as its county seat. So the name of the town was changed by combining the word Indian with Ola, which is Spanish for wave. So literally it means Indian wave. The German immigrants continued to refer to the community as Karlshaven, which is Karl's Harbor, in honor of Prince Karl of Solms-Braunfels. It served as the major port in Texas, and before the 1875 storm was second only to Galveston as Texas's primary port. So that's pretty interesting. In 1856, the port received cargoes of camels, part of the United States Camel Corps experiment to replace horses and mules as primary pack animals in the southwestern part of the U.S. During the American Civil War, Indianola was twice occupied by Union troops. During the second occupation, part of the Union infantry regiment moving from Indianola to Matagorda Island drowned in Matagorda Bay. In 1869, the world's first mechanically refrigerated shipment of beef left Indianola for New Orleans. And during World War II, the United States Army constructed an anti-aircraft firing range along the shoreline to train gunners. And it was mostly used by military personnel from Camp Hewlin, which is located right outside of Palacios. So, unfortunately, the storms wiped away Indianola, and they didn't build a seawall like Galveston did, and a lot of it eroded away, and apparently the site of the old courthouse is actually now underwater. So I think that's pretty fascinating. Independence, Texas, was established in 1835 on 78 acres in Stephen F. Austin's colony by a guy named J.D.W. Pearson, Robert Stevenson, Colbert Baker, and Amasa Burchard. It was a portion of the land concession made by the Mexican government to Thomas S. Saul, who then gave it to Pearson and Baker. The community flourished and developed into an important center for education and religion in the Republic of Texas. This is where it gets interesting. The Independence Baptist Church was founded in 1839. It's the second oldest church connected to the Baptist General Convention of Texas and was still a thriving congregation in the 1990s. In 1854, the church in which Sam Houston belonged baptized him in the Little Rocky Creek, located just 2 miles outside of the community. So there's more information on there. There's a whole lot of stuff about population, but it is technically still a ghost town, but apparently that's also kind of where Baylor College started. So that's also some interesting stuff. So check out Independence. Medicine Mound, which is about 90 miles west of Wichita Falls, and it's 12 miles south and east of Quanah, which I used to serve when I worked for the Boy Scouts, which is out in Hardeman County, and took its name from four local elevations 200 to 250 feet high. The mounds were camps and ceremonial sites of the Comanches. The community moved 2.5 miles north in 1908 when the Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient Railway was built. At one time, Medicine Mound had a population of 522 businesses, including a newspaper called The Citizen. A fire destroyed the town in 1932, but pretty much everything was rebuilt. In 1940, the town had 6 stores, 210 people. The school was consolidated with that, with Quanah in 1955, and the post office and gin were shut down in the 1950s as well. And the population has been around 50 people forever. Legend, though, has it that the hills provided herbs and medicinal plants favored by the Native Americans or Comanches, leading to their name, although modern visitors claim the hills are distinctly lacking in anything that would be called herbs. Who knows? But probably one of the most famous people to visit that area would be Quanah Parker. He would visit that, and that's also where the name Quanah gets the town name of Quanah, Texas. Number 9, Lobo. Lobo is located in the Trans-Pecos region of West Texas between the Van Horn Mountains and the Wiley Mountains in southern Culberson County. The community's history dates back to the mid-1800s when a Bolson aquifer named Van Horn Wells was discovered in the area. The wells were the only known water sources within a radius of 100 miles, and the spring became a stop for the San Antonio-El Paso Road, followed by immigrants traveling to the west. It was followed by the San Antonio-San Diego Mail Line and Butterfield Overland Mail and other mail routes from 1857 until railroads arrived. So, what's interesting about this town, it grew up, and in, So, Culberson County is created in 1911. Lobo vied unsuccessfully with nearby Van Horn to become the new county's seat. And the community had a population of around 20 with a general store and several other businesses. Here's the interesting part. In 1929, an earthquake destroyed Lobo's hotel. Another powerful earthquake struck the community in 1931. By the mid-1930s, the number of inhabitants had fallen to 10. And then it was closed in 1942. But the arrival of the Texas Mica Company and 2 railroad houses caused a little increase in population. Large-scale irrigation commenced in the late 1940s. Cotton became an important crop to the local economy. Anderson, Clayton & Company set up a gin in Lobo, but in 1962, the railroad stop shut down. The population had grown to about 90 in the mid-1960s. And around that time, the water table dropped dramatically and the wells were unable to supply enough water for residents and businesses. And the cost of keeping the irrigation pumps operational skyrocketed and the cotton gin shut down. So, the next interesting thing. In 1969, a guy named Bill Crist buys the entire community and opens up a new gas station and general store. Although business was initially good, the sale of alcoholic beverages caused an increase in crime. The store was destroyed by fire in 1976. In 1988, Crist placed the community on the market for sale for $60,000. By 1991, there was no purchaser, and he was facing personal problems. He abandoned his effort to save Lobo. It became a modern ghost town with limited water and an annual rainfall of about 13 inches. In November of 2001, 3 residents from Frankfurt, Germany, purchased Lobo. They included on fixing up the dilapidated buildings and holding local art and music festivals. Today, there is an irrigated pecan orchard with more than 61,000 trees and the South Lobo Campground, both located within a mile of the old town site. And as of 2023, Lobo, which is kind of a ghost town again for the third time, is for sale for $100,000. So you too can own your own ghost town. Last but not least is Terlingua, Texas. It's kind of a town, kind of a mining district. It's technically a mining district and a census-designated place, or CDP, in southwestern Brewster County. It's located near the Rio Grande and the villages of Lajitas and Study Butte, as well as the Mexican state of Chihuahua, are all located very close together. The discovery of cinnabar, from which the metal mercury is extracted, in the mid-1880s, brought miners to the area, creating a city of about 2,000 people. The only remnants of the mining days are a ghost town of the Howard Perry-owned Chisos Mining Company and several nearby capped and abandoned mines. The California Hill, the Rainbow, the 248, and the Study Butte mines. The mineral Terlinguaite was first found in the vicinity of California Hill. So, now, the discovery of cinnabar in Terlingua is actually kind of shrouded in legend because it's impossible to really cite a date and location of the first quicksilver recovery. The reason is apparently cinnabar was known by the Native Americans for a long time, who apparently used its red color for pictographs. Who knew? They go on through all the mining stuff for kind of ever. You know, the late 1800s, the origin of the town name, Terlingua, may be a corruption of the words tres lenguas, which means three tongues in Spanish. Or it could have been a reference to an early mine or a local feature. No one really knows. By 1903, it had about 3,000 people. And, yeah. On the first Saturday of November, there are over 10,000 chili heads that convene on Terlingua for a two-day, I think it's longer now, annual chili cook-off. The Chili Appreciation Society International and another one. And so there was supposed to be a sponsored Mexican fence climbing contest to spoof the U.S. government's planned reinforcement of the chain link fence separating El Paso from Juarez. But, you know, the fence the chili heads used was constructed by undocumented Mexican workers who labored annually for the cook-off's organizers at $5 a day plus meals and rustic lodging. And so, yeah. So among the founders of the actual first chili cook-off in 1967 was car manufacturer Carroll Shelby, who owned a 220,000-acre ranch nearby. So due to its proximity to Big Bend National Park, today Terlingua is mostly a tourist destination for park visitors. Rafting and canoeing on the Rio Grande, mountain biking, camping, hiking, and motorcycling are some of the outdoor activities favored by those who venture that far out. So there you go. What do you think? 10 ghost towns in Texas. Well, I guess one is kind of Texas, Oklahoma. Let me know what other kind of weird or interesting off-the-wall Texas history you'd like to hear about. I want to thank our sponsors again, me and Victory Home Loans. Send your buddies looking to buy a house over to themichaelmitchell.com. T-H-E-michaelmitchell.com. Remember, I sell dreams, not mortgages. Thank you all for tuning in to Once Upon a Time in Texas. As always, remember, the stars at night are big and bright, deep in the heart of Texas. Y'all have a great week.